All right, kia ora. My name is Ben Lampard. I'm from Webstock, and I'm very pleased to be hosting the 8x5 session. This after-lunch session is sort of a bit of a graveyard shift, I guess. Everyone's had lunch and maybe getting a little bit tired. So what we're going to try and do is liven it up a bit. We've got quite a diverse sort of thing happening here. We're going to have eight speakers, each speaking for 5 minutes on a range of topics, and I'll introduce those people as they come up. Basically, the speakers have 5 minutes to impart their ideas to you. I'm going to be giving them a one-minute warning, and then at 5 minutes, I'm going to ring this old school bell, and hopefully they're going to be finished in that time, and if they go longer than that, I'm going to come screaming at them or something and try and get them off the stage. If you do the math on that, of course, we've got about 40 minutes for talking, and then we've got to change people over, so hopefully everyone's going to be sticking to their 5 minutes. Basically, we'll get straight into it. We're going to be starting off with Philip Feilinger. He's from Shift. He's a user experience strategist. He's originally from San Francisco, where he ran his own digital media agency. And he's worked with some pretty big-name clients, including Sony, PlayStation, DreamWorks, Macromedia, and a very impressive list. He's going to be talking about rapid prototyping using Flash.
Hi, good afternoon. All right, let me just get this machine going here. Okay, here we go. Cool. Okay, so I'm going to sound like a crackhead because I only have 5 minutes. My name is Philip Feilinger, and I'm from Shift here in Wellington, and we also have Auckland offices. And you might know us from such websites as NewZealand.com, and which has just recently won its second Webby Award, a second year running, which we're really happy about. And I really wanted to quickly mention that we're hiring, so if you want to work at a really, really cool place with great people, go to shift.co.nz. I'm here today to talk about rapid prototyping using Flash, and a technique that I've been using for a while, and I want to talk about why I use it and how I use it. Probably most of you, a lot of you, create wireframes, create prototypes of some kind, and the idea is to explore ideas and communicate those ideas. And ideally using the least amount of effort, least resources, least time as possible. And that wraps up to me why I think Flash is the best tool for that. It's extremely agile. It lets me iterate through ideas very, very quickly. I can just draw them out on screen. And then it also lets me experience the interaction flow. So paper, you know, with paper-based prototypes, even like, you know, you do Visio or you do hand-drawn ones, it doesn't give you a very good sense of the interaction flow, clicking through and getting around, navigating around. And HTML is just far too fussy for me, and it has some other limitations that I'll talk about later. So I wanted to walk through some projects where we've used this technique. And so this is a project that we're just wrapping up now. It's just a website. So it had some interesting architectural issues that we had to address. And also used Ajax, and so dynamic interactions. And again, this is really well suited for Flash, where you can mock those up really quickly and really easily. When we started this out, like most of you probably, we did hand drawings and just generated ideas on paper. And then we even kind of developed the framework for the site on paper, but we needed to test out our ideas. It's one thing if it's on paper, but to actually test it out, we wanted to see if it's going to work. And then also to communicate it to the client. It's very important, and this kind of doodles doesn't really fly with clients so well. So I'm going to show you the wireframes that we put together. Are these showing up on screen? Not quite. So this is the wireframe for that site. And, you know, as you can see, it has some interactions here that are dynamic. And I could have done that, you know, built a prototype using HTML and JavaScript, but it would have taken me a lot longer to do than I did this. This is literally just frame-based screens in Flash. So it's go to frame one, go to frame two, go to frame three. Anyone with the most basic knowledge of Flash can build this. And so you can click through and you can get quickly, you know, navigate your way around the site and do dynamic interactions. You can put notes just like you would do kind of in a paper-based document, and you can control that in more interesting ways using Flash. It prints out really well. And so this is something that the the team uses, and we refer to this all the time as we're actually developing the site. Once it goes to HTML, first of all, it's really easy to reference something that, like this and say, well, what were we planning here, and also just the navigation flow, the interaction flow. What were we thinking? Oh, yeah, that triggers this. Blah, blah, blah. And then also with clients, it's something really concrete that they can understand immediately what we're suggesting, what we're and what we're delivering. And then for user testing, we use this for user testing as well, and it's something very easy for users to understand, click through. It feels like a website enough to get an understanding of how to use something. And we got some really great feedback on what's working, what people understood, what didn't work so well, and we could iterate it really, really quickly in Flash. Oh, shoot. Okay. Next one I just wanted to talk to you about was a slightly different technique using the same kind of process, and it's for a large application, a huge, heavy-duty, data-driven blob monstrosity. And in this case, we didn't want to prototype out and actually do full interactions, but we wanted to touch the main key points of the functionality and the content. And so we did something that's scenario-based. And we can also communicate nicely about the whole concept. And we can take one slice, this user, here's what the user, and they're going through and they're navigating. So again, this is just drawing out a story, a narrative story almost. And in fact, I did a narrated version of this. You use a screen capture and you talk over it so that developers can refer to it, come back and to refer to it. And this type of interface, Two seconds. I said I would be 30 seconds over. Sorry. This type of interface, this is hundreds and hundreds, dozens and dozens of iterations down the road. And I could throw out the ones, my previous ones, really quickly and easily and not worry about it. If I did it in HTML, I would be far more reluctant to throw it out. And also, this type of interface is not something that I would have conceived with in HTML. And so, paper may look great on paper, but then when you actually try it out and use it and experience it, it just falls apart and it feels completely wrong. HTML is just too fussy, and that's why Flash, to me, is easy and agile. It combines the best of paper so you can sketch things out really quickly. You don't have to worry about placement and all that. It's just throw it together. But then you can code it up like HTML, and you can actually make it interactive and you can experience it. Thank you very much.
Next speaker is Rachel May. She is talking on standards and .NET. Rachel has a background in fine arts and design and has been specialising in web design for the past 3.5 years. She's been working for a Wellington-based development company called Heliocell. In the areas of project management, design and front-end builds. So, over to you.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Rachel May. As you've just heard, originally I come from a fine arts and design background. Fine arts and design background, and I've been specialising in web design for 3.5 years. And my current position is senior web designer at Heliocell, where we've been currently developing a number of .NET websites and applications. In this session, we're briefly going to look at making web standard applications using Microsoft.NET. And at the end of the session, you should know that .NET can be used for web standard applications successfully. And you'll have a couple of tips for creating better products through creating relationships. And some practical pointers when using .NET. Now, most of the content from this presentation is a result of the process that we have used to create our latest .NET application, which is a web online surveying tool called GoFetch. So how many people here have used or do use .NET for their applications? Cool. .NET has some really, really awesome capabilities. However, like a lot of Microsoft platforms and products, until recently they haven't really taken notice of things like web standards, which means that a lot of us would prefer to use other things like PHP. But .NET 2 does make this easier for us. It has been developed with web standards in mind, and Microsoft boasts that you can make a web application that validates without any extra work. This means that valid code is used in all pre-made .NET controls, and Visual Studio will produce XHTML. If you have the choice, always use .NET 2 rather than .NET 1. But there are some limitations. When they say validate, they do mean validate to a transitional doc type, and for some of us, that's just not really good enough. And they don't just mean valid code, but we also want semantically meaningful code. Just because it validates doesn't mean that it's necessarily the best option. But with communication between your team, these limitations can be worked through. It will take a bit of extra work, but it's my key point today, is communication. So how many people here manage the front-end code, the HTML and the CSS? Cool. And how many of you are developers, like PHP, Ruby, whatever? Awesome. Now, when making a .NET application web standard, communication between both of these parties is absolutely vital. Whether or not you're working like in the same team at a web development company or if you're both contractors, it doesn't matter. You need to talk to each other. Now, if you're a front-end builder like me, we need to talk to developers. It's not very often that you'll come across a .NET developer that is actually already aware of why web standards are important. Now, we need to communicate this to them because making it standard will make extra work for them, and you know that we all hate extra work, so we need to communicate why it's important and communicate it really well. And the communication needs to go both ways. Depending on the complexity of the project, there are some things that we will need to work around together. So communication is really vital when it comes to these more complicated things. Now, I only have time to go over one example of this kind of collaboration between front-end and back-end developers. I've chosen this example of a classic case of where through listening and understanding each other, a great solution can be reached. Now, on the screen is a data table from our latest application, GoFetch. As I mentioned before, the auto-generated .NET controls are not always the best solution. In this case, we could do it two ways. We could approach this by using Microsoft's auto-generated data grids, which are essentially auto-generated tables, where you don't get to control the HTML. However, there is another way. We can also use repeaters. So in this case, I made the table HTML, which includes table headers, TH cells, no presentational code, and delivered it to our developer for integrating to the system. So what this resulted in was a correctly structured table, nicely styled with CSS, but with the complete functionality of .NET, with no extra presentational markup or any of the things like that that .NET would automatically put in. It also helps to separate design structure and functionality, which, as we all know, is really good. So often through both parties talking and listening to each other, there is a solution that works. We just have to be open-minded about finding it. So for an example of a valid .NET application, you can check out GoFetch, which is currently in its final testing phase and is due for release soon. And if you want to come and talk to me afterwards, then that would be cool. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Rachel May. That was perfectly timed. Brilliant. I thought I was going to have to charge up there because I didn't think she'd get through that, but that was incredible. Next up, we have Michael Kozarski with a very brief intro to Ruby on Rails. Now, it's really cool to have Michael here, actually. He's a member of the Ruby on Rails core team, and he lives right here in Wellington. And prior to working on Rails, he was working on big Java systems for some of New Zealand's largest banks. Just an aside there, we've actually got a drink at tonight's cocktails named after Ruby on Rails as well. Just some trivia there. Big hand, please, for Michael.
Just as an aside, I've actually managed to lose my cocktail card, so I don't think I'll be having one of our Ruby on Rails cocktails. G'day. As you said, my name's Michael Kosiowski. I'm a member of the Ruby on Rails core team, and I thought I'd use this fantastic opportunity to give you a very quick introduction. Now, I apologize in advance. This stuff's going to be a little bit developer heavy. I'm a developer, I always have been, and I noticed that there are an awful lot of designers here. Hopefully there's something of use to you guys anyway, and to all you .NET programmers, I'm really sorry to hear about that. Right, so we need to define what Ruby on Rails is, and 5 minutes is not really going to be enough time to cover everything, but the one thing we like to focus on is, well, the one paragraph we like to focus on is that Ruby on Rails is a full-stack web development framework. We write it in Ruby, we favor convention over configuration, we focus on high productivity, and we build from extractions from real-world applications. So I'm going to take each of those points in turn, and hopefully by the end of it you'll have a good idea what Rails is all about, and if not, you can come grab me afterwards. I'm happy to talk about my baby. So first of all, I'll hit full stack. Rails ships with everything you need to build modern web applications. We have database access, we have controllers, we have views, emails, and we have Ajax helpers through Prototype and Scriptaculous. Now, Prototype and Scriptaculous both started within Rails and have since been picked up by hundreds of other copycat frameworks that are out there, and good for them. This is an example of our database access code. As you can see here, there's two little classes, a person, a company. You just annotate the associations. Person belongs to a company has many people, and once you've done that, you can work with those people classes and instances just like you can with any other object within Ruby. We have views. This is an example of our views. Now, we haven't tried to build big fancy data table controls or things that you can drag and drop or templating languages that will work basically like HTML and Dreamweaver. We figure that all of you designers, you're smart enough to know what a for loop is and you're smart enough to know what a helper is. So this is it. This is the view technology for Rails. It's called ERB. Our Ajax helpers, we basically don't use XML in our Ajax, so I don't know what that makes us, something like that. As you can see here, this is fairly typical Ajax call. You have a link there to add something to the cart. You'd click on it. It sends off that XML, HTTP, what's it request. It comes back. The response code gets checked. If it's a 200, then it executes the JavaScript, which gets returned. You'll note here that there's actually no JavaScript there, which is good because JavaScript's hard. I'm too stupid to do it, so I'm glad that we've got helpers that are built in. Now, I said we were written in Ruby, and I really mean it. Everything that we do in Rails is written in Ruby. It's a language that we're passionate about and that we like, so we figure, why have fancy XML configuration files or properties files or anything else? So this is an example from a deployment script from one of my clients. Basically, what it says there is before you update the code, back up the database. Very useful stuff whenever you're deploying a new version of your code to your production servers. Our configuration, this is Ruby as well, even though it may look just like Java properties files. And as I've said earlier, here's our view code. The things in the percents is Ruby code. Everything else is just plain HTML. Unlike the Java guys, we didn't invent another language for this. We're actually quite proud of Ruby. We didn't see the need to hide behind JSTL or JSFEL or any of those other lovely technologies. One of the big things that we're really, really passionate about is convention over configuration. Now, what this means is that we're opinionated. We lay out the official way for you to do things. If you want to, you can choose another way, but it's going to be more work and more code, and really, it doesn't matter. So for convention here, as you can see that URL, by looking at that, Rails knows you want to go to the context controller, call the show action, and pass the ID as 45. Now, if you've got some other crazy URL naming scheme or anything else, you can make basically anything you want work. You'll just need to do a couple of lines of code in your routes file, and yes, that's Ruby code down there as well. Database configuration is another area where we're really heavy on the convention over configuration. A lot of people will just be recoiling in horror. What we've done here is we've called our primary key ID, and our foreign keys are called things like company ID, and our tables are called people instead of something crazy. If you wanted to use another naming standard, that's fine. You can. As you can see, you just have to tell Rails what you're talking about. You need to tell it what the table's called, what the primary key's called, what the foreign key is, and basically how it's going to work. So what does this mean? Basically, for developers, you do less busy work, you focus on your applications, you have fewer bugs because you write less code, and you have more fun. Why should managers care? Projects cost less, projects ship sooner, and your developers are happier. I know that since I switched to working with Ruby on Rails, I've been much, much more relaxed, and my employers do a lot better out of that. Replacing a developer is much more expensive than buying an extra 10% of a CPU. The last thing that we're really proud about is extraction. All of the features from Rails come from real-world applications. What this means is that Rails is a collection of solutions to problems that people actually had, not problems that they figured they might have one day. We don't do design by committee. Finally, what people often ask is, does Ruby on Rails scale? Well, yes, it does. Basecamp, the application that started all of this, has hundreds of thousands of people managing their projects every single day. StrongSpace, an application I was involved with, has hundreds of thousands of people using it, with terabytes of data being uploaded every day. These three sites, A List Apart, which you may have heard of, Penny Arcade and 43 Things, all do millions of hits every day, and there are a variety of new startups that are coming in every day, pushing the boundaries of Ajax and Ruby on Rails. If you're interested, that's my email address, that's our address. Thanks very much.
That was brilliant. Cheers. Thank you very much for that, Michael. That was awesome. Next up, we have Robin Hunt. She's going to be talking about all the information for all of the people, all of the time, and what does that mean? Now, Robin is acknowledged as one of New Zealand's leading experts in the field of disability. She's the co-founder of ACEase, a company dedicated to information accessibility on the web and elsewhere. Please give her a warm welcome.
Kia ora. Well, what does all of the information for all of the people, all of the time mean? We asked a few users and site owners to tell us. And I'll begin with me as a user. Always sounds like I'm addicted to something, doesn't it, when I say a user? Anyway, I'm vision impaired and I rely on browser settings for enlargement, and I can tell you I can break your beautiful sight. If I can't use a website easily and I'm not that patient, I'll just pick up the phone and waste someone's time until I get the information that I want, which was probably on the website, but I couldn't get at it. I have to use the web to access information for work. If I can't get the information, then I can't do my job properly. Another of our vision impaired testers, who also has a physical disability, she uses screen enlargement software, and she says, it allows people with disabilities to apply for jobs in government departments online without having to struggle to fill in forms by hand. But many government departments aren't accessible because their application forms are in PDF, the dreaded PDF, the creature from the Black Lagoon, or in Word. And of course, it makes it very difficult for people to complete those forms. Accessibility is becoming more important for students who want to study by distance education, she says. And she's had to pull out of a course because the web-based content was inaccessible. For some people, the web may be the only source of information. They have little or no choice. A quadriplegic user with a voice-operated computer and mouse with headphones and toolbar, head pointer and toolbar and a large screen resolution explains, I want to know where and how to access goods and services that will allow me to live independently in the community. These may include government departments, services particularly for disabled people, or services that cater for everyone. For instance, I want to do my banking, to shop, to read my newspaper online. On the rare occasions I go out, I want to use the internet to plan my trip in advance. I want interactive online maps that will show me how to get from A to B and answer questions about accessible transport options. I want to browse the local library and have books ready for me when I call. I want information about entertainment and leisure activities and to be able to book in advance. I want to use the internet for work and play. As a writer, I want easy access to research material and to information on having my work published. As a Catholic, I want to have access to the Bible and to spiritual guidance. As a student of Māori language, culture and history, I want websites where I can indulge my hobby in my own time and at my own pace. Government sites often hold essential information. A user with severe dyslexia using reading software says, I've become more aware how inaccessible many government sites are. It's important I could find the information I want. They could change simple things, like the menus and headings within the page. All I can do is click on all the links and all the content, unless the links are words and the words are not images. Sitemaps need to be clearly visible from the menu so you can highlight the whole content and let the reader read them and find the one you want. Less Java. I can highlight the words, but it can take a long time. Usually I wouldn't bother. I'd just pick up the phone. But disabled users aren't the only ones who find accessibility useful. A senior manager told us, I don't regard myself as having a disability, but I've been unable to access information on websites because I've left my glasses at home and the sites don't enlarge. I can't do my job without the information. Many offices only have IE, which only enlarges if your website's set up to enlarge. And a rural user complains bitterly. I need to source information for machinery and farm products and to do my banking online. Dial-up disconnects, sometimes takes two goes to connect. It's unbelievably slow. And you can't download anything in any kind of reasonable time. And I've given up downloading. It times out for banking. Sometimes it goes through once, sometimes it doesn't go through at all, but it times out. we're left behind. Web owners can see the sense in web accessibility. Planned accessibility is absolutely essential to our websites for several reasons. As a government-supported website, our information must be as easily available as possible. A significant proportion of readers use accessibility functionality, and this will increase as people with an ageing population. As an information site for community sites, we are used by disabled people, and we must walk the talk, and we want to maintain best practice. With planned accessibility, we get small page file sizes, browser compatibility, clear, understandable navigation, readable information, in short, usability. If accessibility is planned in from the start, the costs are minimal. In fact, it'll save money in things like less bandwidth and easier maintenance. And communications managers say, we have to get to the widest population that we can. It's a really good way to measure the success of a public information campaign. We want our information to go to as wide an audience as possible. The power of the web is in its universality. Access by everyone, regardless of disability, is an essential aspect. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Robin. That was excellent and timely as well. Very good. Next up, we have Mike Zimmern. He is from talking about searchbots.net. He is a lecturer and subject director in digital media at Massey University. Prior to joining Massey, he was founder and director at Morse Media Limited, which is a Wellington new media design studio. Thanks. Let's have a big hand.
Great, thanks. So what I'm going to do here today is talk about search bots, and I'm basically launching this research project today. It's part of a Masters in Design, which I'm currently doing up at Massey, so it's kind of like a startup. It starts today. but it has good history. So what is a search bot? Back in 1999, think about sort of search bots. Think about the sort of language that we used back then, and you hear these sort of terms like information highway, these great sort of mythologies that existed. And one of them was that you would have an avatar or an agent that would go out there and do things for you on your behalf. So what we did in 1999 is we came up with some slick Flash stuff. We basically wanted to show off Flash Generator when it first launched, and we wanted to prove to our clients that we've got a really slick way here to personalize graphics. So that no longer exists, but what we were really interested in that is the mythology. And we allowed ourselves to search in more creative ways. So you could search by color or you could search by mood. So if you search for the color red, you might find a website about tomatoes or anger management or communism. You might find all sorts of things. And people really responded to this. They really loved the idea of having a search bot, an agent that was out there. And when you first signed up, we sent out an email. And then what we started to discover is that people would email us back as if they were talking to their search bot. So on Friday nights, we'd sit around with a few beers and we'd email people back pretending to be their search bots. And we'd kind of maintain this sort of mythology when, in fact, this was completely fake. We had about 200 websites in it that were just our personal bookmarks. It didn't really exist, but yet we had 30,000 people that built their own custom search bots wanting it to be kind of believable and true. So kind of hooking into what Kathy was talking about yesterday and Joel this morning, we started with the lipstick. There was nothing underneath it. But obviously the problem with that is it became unsustainable. We just couldn't run it. It was an experiment. So we had to shut it down after about a year, and it's been offline for 5 years. So we're relaunching today as a research project. And the main thing that I'm looking at now is how can I make this an open content search engine? So how can I bring in the community and actually get them to submit information? Because what I'm interested in is more of those human sort of aspects. So if I can be so bold to compare it to Google, what I'm interested in is more of the qualitative information, people's opinions. Search bots is a little bit more about entertainment, the best results. It's about community and how you contribute to that community. And with the color thing, Google's never going to be able to figure out a website's color. So, but people can do that. And as you know, most AI research hasn't led to much at the moment. The best things we've got are people's common sense, where they've played word games and they've loaded the common sense into a database and we can use that. So I'm looking at that same kind of mechanism. And it runs on top of all the great APIs that have come out. So it actually runs on top of Google and on top of Yahoo, on top of Delicious, on top of Magnolia, Flickr, any kind of AP that comes out. I'm going to look at microformats after this morning. I'll be able to plug it all in. It'll become kind of like an aggregator with people's opinions on top. So here's a version 2 search bot. And the main thing I'm looking at my masters is what motivates people to contribute information. So I've got two main ideas that I'm playing with. One is sort of narrative, and the other one is game theory, and how we can use these. So if we're talking about narrative, what happens when your search bot breaks down, when it powers down after you've done a certain amount of searching? Will I be able to use these sort of graphics to motivate people to contribute? So you don't get 100,000 results, you just get a certain amount and it kind of runs out. Game theory, do you collaborate or compete, collude or cheat? You know, how can I bring in some strategies? You know, rather than giving all the information away out front, how can I reveal it over time in an interactive way, you know, challenge the user a little bit, have a tit-for-tat sort of strategy to actually bring the information back out of the user. So the key kind of idea is that out of the self-interest of the user comes collaboration. So here's a few screenshots just to give you a sort of taster. So a part of the process that you can do is you kind of build your own bot, put parts together, you color it. And part of what I'm experimenting with here is that it does this act of personalization increase kind of empathy. You know, when the bot actually starts to power down, will it help you, you know, will it encourage you to submit information rather than just a form going, you know, give me stuff. And something else I'm playing with, this is all 100% sort of Flash, using full browser Flash, which is a great technique if no one's looked at it. And I'm playing around with interactive sort of tag clouds, so you can drag these words around, give them hierarchy, you know, more visual sort of fun ways of actually presenting information and you know, seeking feedback. So you have a bot, it has a power bar, you can drag in search chips, you get instant results, and as well as that, you set up your ongoing search, so you know, your persistent search. The sort of results you get back are all kind of visual. You know, it's all about sort of screenshots and kind of information. And then after you've started using your bot for a while, it will start to power down and, you know, now you've got to feed it, keep it alive. So I'm really looking at the story, you know, how we can use sort of narrative, how we can use game theory to really encourage people to submit to an open source sort of website. So I'd encourage you all today to kind of log in, make a search bot. It's still halfway under development, so give me a few more weeks, but you can go there, have a play, and check it out. Cheers.
Thank you very much, Mark. That was excellent, really interesting. Next up, we've got Steve Dickinson. He is going to be talking about, well, the subject of his talk is 99% visual is good. Steve has worked in the IT industry for the past 20 years. You wouldn't think that, though. Eight of which were for IBM UK, and the past three have been here in New Zealand. He formed Abstract Engineering in 2004 with the sole objective of creating a product to combat a communications problem that he's encountered time and time again on IT projects, and he's going to tell us more about that. Big hand for Steve.
Hi, my name is Steve Dickinson. I realise now that the title is slightly controversial, but I'm going to push on anyway. My background is with IBM working on large IT projects. The problem that I came across constantly was, they say a picture paints 1,000 words. The problem I was having as an architect is I was constantly drawing diagrams. So after 1,000 pictures, I realized that there must be a better way. What I did was to stand back from the problem of drawing pictures and see if the pictures could draw themselves. These are just some quotes that I used during the initial build, really to inspire me, that seemed to capture the essence of the problem here. And it's really a communication problem between people. Just to summarize these, things get complicated very quickly. It's really all about the relationship. You can see information, but it's quite difficult to see the interrelationships between things and the dependencies. Things change all the time. And it's really about teams. In the right environment, teams can be collectively smart. And I've come across a recent one called Bounded Awareness, which seems to summarize the problem of people's inability to make decisions or even look for data. The basic problem summarized with a few diagrams, and I'll show you a demo around bounded awareness, is that people generally fail unless they have the right mechanisms to see information, seek information, use it, and share it. This is a fairly simple environment where there's a small team, where access to information is fairly easy because you can speak to people, and most of the time they'll know the answer. The problem gets worse as the teams get larger in a department. You still have to find the information, but the people that you speak to are busier. The information is more spread out. The projects that I worked on, and this could even be a picture of the internet, they were large corporations. There were people in different departments. Even worse, they outsourced parts of the operation to third parties, which you think might help, but it just makes things worse. And again, the basic problem is the inability to access people. You don't meet with the people. And what tends to happen to solve this at a local level is that people form teams. There'll be groups of people who will have ways of communicating between themselves. So application developers will have one modeling environment, business people will have another, and so on. The problem for the poor guy in the middle, which is me, it's not a mustache, it's a sad face, is that unless you're working in those teams, it's quite hard to find the information. And there's generally a need to get access across the whole environment. And a typical problem is if somebody new joins a company, the only way they can find information is to hang around, basically, and not just read the manuals, as you're usually told to do. So I stood back from this problem, having seen it, and realized that what was needed, and it's a coming together of technology, really, is a way of extracting information from those various models that exist using XML and transformations, providing a way so that users could interact with the information that they're seeing. So if they see something that's wrong, they can change it using things like XForms. That's the users contributing. And also there's a need for people to create local content. So they might want to create a spreadsheet or a Word document. Without a central piece of information, they'd create that and maintain it separately, which is mostly what the problem is. So I came across a product name called CentraFlow, which broken down means centralized trust or truth, because if you don't trust it, you won't use it, and flow, because it's about information flow. But it's not just about a database. It's about how people access the information and how they perceive the information, and it's really around visualization. This is just a diagram that I found showing visualization. I came across this tool called Visual Thesaurus and bought the development kit, and here are some demos quickly. Three demonstrations. One is showing an IT environment. This is the problem that I'm solving for customers at the moment, where they need to be able to see things. So if we have a look at Wellington and the production environment and the development environment, then basically the diagram is drawing itself based on data from either the system management tool. And you basically browse around the model and have a look at information. So if I have a look at abstract engineering, it's just an example. Other modes you can have, here's a timeline, which is just showing me when the applications were installed or when they were purchased by that server. Another example I've got is a photocopier, which I did for a life cycle analysis company, which shows the components in a photocopier to make decisions around sustainable usage, basically. And as a special bonus, I did a Webstock demonstration, 5 minutes. There's me sweating. And finally, where is it? Here we go. It hasn't finished yet. There we go. You can make it 3D, which is kind of goofy, but it's interesting to look at. So if anybody can see any applications for this, just let me know. It's just me at the moment. I'm doing this with a couple of graduates, but I've quit my job and done this. I've got one or two prospects. I've got a live user now, which is great. They can give me feedback. But remember, you saw it here first. See you next year. Hopefully, I'll still be around. Thank you.
Cheers. Thanks very much, Steve. That's great. I'm pretty amazed. We're keeping pretty good time here, actually. I'm just amazed there hasn't been some sort of major technical glitch so far. Next up, we've got Teresa Cunnington. Great, thought there might have been a technical glitch just as I said that. Her topic is the hunting of user experience, an agony in 5 minutes, with apologies to Lewis Carroll. Teresa has been annoying designers and developers since 1994 in pursuit of good user experience. She'd like to be put out of a job, surprisingly, by diligent designers and developers who understand where she's coming from, but reluctantly believe she has a long working life ahead of her. Please give a big hand for Teresa.
I gather I've got a few Lewis Carroll fans in the audience then. Unfortunately, I won't be presenting this in rhyme. There's too many iams in usability and accessibility. But yes, my name's Teresa Cunnington. I'm a usability designer, and I work for iFocus in Melbourne, Australia, and I would love you to put me out of work. I'm going to spend the next 5 minutes ranting about the sorts of mistakes that even the big designers make with regards to user experience. So keep this sort of stuff in mind whenever you're designing something, and I'll never darken your door. I've picked three of my favourite user bugbears: context of use, mental models, and design versus art. So, I figure out how to use my laptop. Speaking of user experience, rant the first, context of use. Oh, back again. So, for a moment, let's think about, so who's going to use it? Why are they using it? When are they using it? How are they using it? I want you to close your eyes and imagine that you've just flown into Wellington. It's 1 a.m. because that's all Qantas does. You're jet-lagged, and all you want to do is find your room and go to bed. You find your floor, and you look for room 6, and you're confronted with this. What the? Are you sharing a room with somebody? How the hell does this work? You go to put your key in the door, and it doesn't work. Then the motion-activated light in the hallway goes off. You're in the dark, you're tired, your luggage weighs a ton, and you can't even open the freaking door. Welcome to my first user experience in Wellington. Turns out that lock doesn't even work. The door leads to a short hallway to the rooms 5 and 6, which have separate locked doors. What's the point of this door? Why is it even here? So you can have a guess about the sort of user experience I was having about that stage. I felt angry, I felt stupid, and I felt confused. So what sort of user experience is that? Understanding the context of use is absolutely vital in whatever you design. How will people be using your design? Will they be under pressure? Will they be tired? Will they be using it in conjunction with other applications and tools? Are they using it in a noisy environment? What sort of technology are they running it on? You must understand your users and the context of use in order to produce positive user experiences. Don't make it more complicated than it needs to be, especially when jet lag's involved. Mental models. So users have certain expectations about how things work. Let me demonstrate this by embarrassing myself painfully. Remember these things? Some of you might. This one has a lovely slidey volume control on the side so that you can adjust it, whether it's playing a tape or you're listening to the radio. TV remotes. No matter what mode the TV is set to, games, DVD, video, broadcasting, the telly. And if you look at the blue buttons, on the side, you can see the lovely mental mapping. Up means the volume goes up, down means the volume goes down. And this stereo has a lovely big shiny silver knob that you can turn, and you can use the volume, whether it's playing a CD, whether it's connected to the TV, listening to a tape, the radio, it doesn't matter. Non-modal volume controls. You can adjust them no matter what. Then I bought this. And I discovered the hard way that the iPod has a modal volume control. I couldn't, for the life of me, on the first day that I owned it, adjust the volume. I'd accidentally disabled the volume control by being in the wrong screen. It took me a day to figure it out. Do you know what I had to do? The volume control. It broke my mental model about how volume controls worked. Bad iPod, no biscuit. But worst of all, I felt embarrassed, I felt frustrated, and I felt defeated by technology. What sort of user experience is that? So how do users expect whatever it is that you design to work? Do they have preconceived ideas? Are there things existing in the world about what they're supposed to be doing? Changing established mental models changing them at your own risk, how does breaking the mental model actually improve the experience for your users? My favourite rant. Design is not art. Design is problem solving. Good design is elegant problem solving. Your site could be the most beautiful thing on the web. The code could be valid and compliant, and it could have more Ajax than the cleaning aisle in a supermarket. But if it doesn't solve a problem, if it doesn't serve the business, if it doesn't serve your users, there's no point for it to exist. This is the Alessi Juicy Salaf. I thought it was an excellent elegant combination of form and function. The shape of the juicer and the ridges channel the juice down. It's shiny and retro-looking. It's cool. It's also appalling design. Try juicing with it. It's too tall to exert effective effort on the fruit. The legs skitter across the bench top. Half the juice runs down the legs, and it doesn't filter out the pulp or the pips. It doesn't even catch the juice in anything. Compare it with this, if you can actually... Oh, yes, you can see it. It's stable, it's a good height, it catches all the juice, filters out the pits, and it even has a pouring lip. The Juicy Salaf is art. This is design. I felt angry, deceived, irritated, bad user experience. Remember, you're problem solving, not just creating cool stuff. Whatever you design, it must be usable, useful, and engaging. Sorry, you don't get a chance to read the quote properly. Creating good user experience requires you to talk to your users, know them, talk to them, love them, just don't love them. Too many designers try to solve the wrong problem or too many problems at once. Keep it simple. Think about the context of use. Don't label a button static asset ingest when you mean file upload. I've seen it done. Match your users' mental models. Just because your CMS can display the breadcrumb trail backwards doesn't mean the users will get it. I've seen it done. Remember, design is not art. Even if you're an artist and you're putting a portfolio on the web, employers need to know how to use your portfolio. Let elegant design create beautiful user experiences. I look forward to being unemployed. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Teresa. That was excellent. Our final 8x5, I'm not quite sure how to introduce this, so I'm just going to let these guys come on. They're all the way from the Provoke Love Lounge. Please give a big hand to Bob.
Thank you. This makes a change to a normal Wednesday lunchtime, I can tell you that. My name's Bob. This is my colleague, Zeph. And we're employed by Provoke Solutions, and they are New Zealand's premier software development company. So I should sort out my bonus for this year. So why are we here? We're here for shits and giggles, really. Nothing serious. So in the spirit of Webstock and Woodstock, we thought we'd give you a bit of light relief and a bit of a song. And this is the times on the web, they are a-changing. So apologies to Bob Dylan. Okay, this may or may not work. We didn't have a sound check, really. I can't even see the guitar with this harmonica in the right. Come gather round web gurus wherever you roam, and for 3 days admit that Webstock is your home. And accept it that soon you'll be flickered to the bone. If your time here is spent collaborating, well, the user now will be later to win. For the times on the web are a-changing. Come coders and designers who prophesize with your mouse, finding new ways for the whole world to browse. And don't speak too soon, cause if it works in Firefox, it'll still need a hack for IE. But if you blog it first, it could pay off your house. The times on the web are a-changing. Table-based layouts please heed the call. Don't block up the bandwidth, don't validate at all. It's 2006, so please get on the ball. Your old code is rapidly aging, but adopting web standards could redeem your soul, cause the times on the web are a-changing. Come clients and marketers throughout the land, and don't criticize what you don't understand. Your users and customers are beyond your command. There's a battle outside and it's raging. Google Web 2.0 to improve your hand, cause the times on the web are changing. The sites they are built, the URL is cast. The dial-up now will be broadband fast, as the present now will later be past. Well, the order is rapidly fading. As the first one now will later be last, cause the times on the web are changing.
Well, thanks very much. That was excellent. Could you all just give another big round of applause to everyone that spoke? They were all really, really fantastic, I think.